All right, so we're going to get started here. When I was given this topic, I thought, well, maybe, you know, it might be 20 or 30 people that would come. I had no idea. All right, so apparently this is a topic of significant interest. We have a pretty wide range of, like, we have Carlos Santos back there, who's getting a PhD in Christian philosophy. This is all stuff he knows really well. Then we have people who really know very little science at all.
Right.
And I'm going to aim this class towards the second group.
Okay.
All right. I once had a physics professor who was giving a lecture on quantum chromodynamics. And he said, I'm going to dumb this down. I know there's people who are undergrads here. I'm going to keep it as simple. Don't worry. And then I was a PhD student. I didn't understand a single word he said. That was so obnoxious. So hopefully I'll actually do that.
Amen.
All right, great. We're ready to start. Let me give you a little bit of background. I was raised in a denominational church, Episcopalian, it was a fairly liberal denomination. And I was the president of the church youth group and all that sort of stuff. But I was also a pot-smoking knucklehead who claimed to be an atheist. So I went off to the University of Connecticut there, and I was so proud to be an atheist. I remember the Christian guy, you know, sharing in the dorm Josh McDowell was doing a thing. This is in 1974. Josh McDowell's pretty old, but anyway. And I remember, like, laughing at that guy. Ah, good. This person left her phone here. Could somebody walk out with this and find her? Oh, she's here. Great.
Thank you.
Okay. So anyway, and I went off to college. I was studying chemistry. And in the process of studying science, I came to realize there's a God. All right, and that sent me on a journey. It was about 2 or 3 years later that I actually came to Christianity. In fact, in the first half of our talk, I'm going to establish what I believe beyond a reasonable doubt, there is a God. So the second half of my talk, I'm talking a bit more like about, all right, fine, well, which actual God? So that was a bit of a journey for me. So what I'm going to do then is I'm going to share with you a few of the reasons that I, as a scientist, believe that belief in God is not only reasonable, but to not believe in God borders on unreasonable and even irrational. So I'm going to be using things that I teach in introductory chemistry and introductory physics classes. I've been a professor of chemistry and physics for about 35 years, retired 4 years ago, and now I'm working as a minister, and my wife and I planted a church a couple months ago. So here we go. So I'm going to present two potential views about the reality of nature. The first one would be the atheist view or the determinist view or the materialist view, which would be represented by Thomas Huxley, who said, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth, the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." Notice, man was made flesh. He's purposely kind of using the Bible there a little bit to kind of like sort of stick it to believers. So the question is this a reasonable view given what we know, especially from science? In fact, Thomas Huxley was good friends with Charles Darwin, and he was known as Darwin's bulldog. By the way, Huxley was the one who invented the word agnostic, and he was a hardcore unbeliever. Charles Darwin was not. Charles Darwin was a deist. Anyway, another possible quote I could use to kind of represent this materialist perspective, the materialist explanation of reality, would be that of Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion. And he said, "In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe, he claims, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music." Now, if that were true, it certainly would be depressing. But Dawkins would say, well, buck up, because that's the reality. Too bad for you. Okay, but the thing is, I kind of work in a world where this is normal, this perspective. And by the way, I'll just give you the numbers. I taught in a chemistry department for a number of years. Okay. All right, that's what I preferred, but some other people wanted it down. So, all right. Who needs to read the slides? I like to see the people that I'm talking to. But anyway. So the chemistry department where I taught, there were three believers, three unbelievers, and one hard to say. So this idea that all scientists do not believe, that's actually not true. But the fact is, the loud ones are the atheists. That's the fact. All right, so let me present another possible perspective, which is the idea of design. William Paley, late 1700s, developed the idea of the watchmaker argument. But I want somebody to give me instead there we go. I need a very good. Instead of a watch, we'll have a cell phone. All right, let's imagine you're walking down the street and you see that cell phone. All right, you're thinking, how'd that get there? Well, two possibilities. One, just a series of beneficial accidents. So there was some metal, some plastic, some copper, maybe a little bit of lithium, and the car ran over it, boom, cell phone. That is crazy. Which has more evidence for design? The simplest living thing or the cell phone? Because the simplest living thing is a nanofactory of almost unimaginable complexity. In fact, maybe instead of using the pocket watch as my example of what would have to come about by nature, instead maybe we could use, say, I need to change, and we shouldn't do 740s, that picture is too old. We got to do a Boeing A, whatever, I don't know. 880, okay, great. Imagine this, imagine you had a junkyard, plastic, metal, all this sort of stuff. A tornado runs through it, and out pops a 747. things that are designed show evidence of design. It's hard to quantify design. You can't measure it. So this concept of design is not an inherently even a scientific idea, but it's something that I think any human could understand. That is not the result of a long series of singularly beneficial accidents. So I'm going to argue that life and many other aspects of nature as well are more like this. So I'm going to go back. I'm going to start with chemistry. Now, hopefully, if you saw the H and the O and the H, you don't need the label on the left-hand side. Hopefully, you're... All right, good. Water. Now, I could teach an entire one-semester class simply to describe the properties of water. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And so the question begs the question, is this accident, or is it evidence of some intelligent designer here? All right, a few of the properties of water. And again, if you don't understand every single one of these properties and its implications, it's okay. The idea is going to be pretty clear. For example, in order for life to exist, there has to be a solvent. It requires a liquid within which the chemicals that support life can actually move around. It has to have a liquid. All right. And it turns out only a few compounds are actually liquid in the right temperature range, because life can only be supported somewhere between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Outside, below that range, there's not enough energy to support chemical reactions to keep something alive. Above that temperature, the molecules simply fall apart. Now, not only that, not only does this solvent have to be liquid, it has to dissolve a wide variety of materials. It has to be able to dissolve ionic compounds such as salt. It also has to be able to dissolve organic compounds that are not ionized. And guess what compound dissolves a wider range of materials than any other? The answer is water. Okay, but water does not dissolve everything, because if it did, we would be a puddle, and that would be a bit of a problem. In fact, whatever this solvent is, whatever this liquid is that supports life, one absolute requirement is it would have to be able to dissolve ions. Because if you can't dissolve ions, you can't have a nervous system and you can't have life. All right. And by the way, water is the only liquid in the entire universe in the correct temperature range that even dissolves ions at all. No other liquid does. Water has a few other unique features. One thing is water has a high specific heat. That's a big word. What it means is water absorbs a lot of energy. In fact, water absorbs more heat than almost all other compounds by a factor of 10, and every other substance by at least a factor of 2. So why does that matter? Well, if water didn't... By the way, the same compound that's the liquid solvent, otherwise you couldn't have life, is also the compound that absorbs the most heat. Coincidence, what do you think? Because otherwise, the temperature of the Earth would go up and down by 200 or 300 degrees centigrade. All right, for the rest of you, 500 or 600 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? Got it? And life would disappear. Okay, now another requirement for life is that this particular liquid, at the right temperature, right solvent properties, and right heat-absorbing properties, it also has to have the property that the solid floats on the liquid. Can you think of any substance for which the solid actually floats on top of the liquid?
No.
Water. Yeah, duh. You know how many compounds have the solid float in the liquid? There are millions and millions of compounds. There is exactly one compound for which the solid floats on the liquid, and that's water. Because generally, colder things are more dense. They sink. Why is that important? Well, it turns out in the winter, when it's really cold out, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, the lake would freeze to the bottom, which, you know, if the lake froze to the bottom, I suppose. But what about during ice ages when the oceans would have frozen to the bottom? Life would have been removed. Maybe some bacteria might have survived. Maybe. Another thing about water, it's so strange. Every other substance in the world, if you graph density versus temperature, it goes like this. All right? There is exactly one substance which does this. It's water. Between 0 and 4 degrees centigrade. So what that means is in the winter, generally, heat rises, right? You know the only exception?
Water.
Well, because it turns out the colder water next to the ice floats on top of the warmer water. And if you've lived in, like, New Hampshire, you know how the lakes turn around. You know what that's about, okay? Again, unique. And by the way, there are other properties of water that are unique to water, but I'm going to go on to another thing. Some of you may have to turn away for a minute because this is going to give you CTSD, not PTSD, CTSD, I guess. All right, great. Now, there are a lot of different elements, and a few of them have unique properties. In fact, there are at least 22 elements I know of that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. Now, here's a question to the atheist. Why are there so many elements? Because life requires so many different things to happen in order for it to exist. I'll just give one example. It'll be carbon. All right, there's one. All right, carbon, I teach organic chemistry. And when I teach organic chemistry, I spend the first two lectures, the entire lecture is on the properties that are unique to carbon that no other element has. And in every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have that property, the thing is carbon has to have all those properties. If it had one and another element had the other one, it wouldn't work. It has to be carbon. All right, and so I'm going to give you some information. Now, if a couple of these things you don't quite get exactly because you're not a chemist, don't worry, the general idea is going to be clear here. All right, so one property of carbon is that it forms four bonds. Actually, it's not the only element that forms four bonds because also silicon does. Now, do we have any Star Trek fans? All right, there's this Star Trek episode. It's the worst one, practically. You don't even see it in reruns. And there's this monster in the cave, and Spock goes, oh, very logical, silicon monster. It's kind of a reference to this thing here. All right. By the way, I haven't told you why it's important to have four bonds. Just bear with me. And it turns out silicon also forms four bonds. But the problem is, if you connect two silicon atoms to each other, that molecule explodes. That's a problem. All right. So anyway, why do we need four bonds? Because it turns out if you have one bond, it's linear. Two bonds is linear. Three bonds is planar. Four bonds, it's three-dimensional. And unless you have four bonds, the molecule can't be three-dimensional. If you don't have three-dimensional molecules, you can't have three-dimensional life. So carbon is the only possibility there. But another property that the life-sustaining element has to have is it has to form large molecules. Guess how many elements allow us to form large molecules? Only one, and that is carbon. So carbon forms large molecules. It has four bonds. It also forms rings and double bonds, all this other technicality stuff. I'll just move on from that. That's the rest of the organic chemistry lecture. Yeah. All right, there's another one. Let's go back to our periodic chart here. Hard to see, but it'll work. There's iron. Okay, iron has a property that no other element has, which is it forms in its natural state a strong magnetic field. And again, that's essential to life. Because if it didn't do that, where would you put your kids' homework? Okay, that's not the problem. The problem is that in order for life to be sustained, we need an energy source. And the source of that energy has to be very, very hot. It's called the sun. And we could talk about the properties of hydrogen that are unique to hydrogen, because if hydrogen didn't have that property, there'd be no stars, but I'll just put that aside. The bottom line is, 90% of the energy coming from the sun is in the form of visible light. That's the only kind of light that can catalyze chemical reactions without destroying molecules. So thank you, God, for designing stars that have 90% of the energy visible light. But there are two forms of energy that come from all stars, which would completely eliminate all life. All right? And two different elements are responsible for canceling out those two kinds of energy. One of them is iron. Because the sun puts out these high-energy particles, electrons and protons, high-energy particles, the solar wind, if you will, which is what causes the aurora borealis and australis. But then the magnetic field of the Earth literally is a force field. All right, in fact, that's one of the biggest problems in going to Mars, is they have to provide a shielding to protect themselves, because once you leave the ionosphere of the Earth, you don't have that protection. Now, here's the interesting thing. Not only is iron the only element that forms a strong magnetic field, it just so happens to be the most stable element, in terms of its nucleus. So what element is the Earth made up out of mostly? Iron. Why? Because it's the most stable element. So if for example, let's say, vanadium was the only magnetic element, that we'd be out of luck, because there's hardly any vanadium. So it just so happens, atheists, help me out here, it just so happens the only element that forms a magnetic field is also the most common element in the Earth. Otherwise, we'd be in big trouble. By the way, the other kind of energy that's necessary to be blocked by something is hard UV rays. And again, we got this whole protection system. It's called the ozone layer. So we have oxygen. And the cool thing is, oxygen forms two functions, two completely separate functions that are necessary to sustain high metabolism life. And oxygen has two forms. There's O2, normal oxygen. There's O3, ozone. So O2, almost all of which is down near the surface of the Earth, allows high metabolism life to exist. And then there's the other form, O3, which is highly toxic and poisonous. If you live in L.A., you breathe quite a bit of it, but hopefully not too much. So luckily, almost all the ozone is in the upper atmosphere, and it blocks the ultraviolet. Good plan. And again, is it reasonable to see this as just an accident? Why? Ask the atheist a simple question. Why? Okay, one more. Okay, uranium. And by the way, I said there's 22. I'm skipping. I'm just doing four of them. Uranium, probably you think uranium is dangerous. It is. Actually, uranium is not as dangerous as you think. Now, I'm not proposing you put a chunk of uranium on your desk. But uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Lucky for us. Why? And by the way, the reason, if we did not have a very long half-life radioactive element to compose the Earth, then the Earth would have, it produces heat. The Earth would have been solid all the way down to the middle by now, which would be pretty problematic, because then we wouldn't have plate tectonics. And by the way, uranium is very, very dense. So where's most of it go, of course? To the center of the Earth. Thank you. Luckily. I say luckily with in quotes, right? So anyway, if we didn't have plate tectonics, because plate tectonics is like this massive recycling system which recycles the minerals which are responsible for maintaining life. There are places in the Earth where there's been almost no actual plate tectonics, like parts of northern Canada, and practically nothing grows there. Also, if we didn't have plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere. That would also be problematic. So if you don't want to live on a planet with much uranium, go to Mars. There's hardly any uranium there. There's also no plate tectonics of significance, and also virtually no atmosphere and very sterile surface. So there's four elements. And again, a little chemistry. Let's talk about biochemistry. Well, I love teaching biochemistry because my students, they kind of figure out I'm a Christian pretty early on, you know. I once had a student try to get me sued by the school for posting Christian stuff on my website. But anyway, so I love teaching biochemistry because there's so many moments I can stop the class and go, kind of like that, you know. So anyway, what about DNA? I'm sure all of you have heard about DNA. DNA is the molecule that contains the information that's responsible for life. We've got the A, the T's, the C's, and the G's. These are nucleotides. These nucleotides are very unique molecules. And basically, the nucleotides produce a code. Three nucleotides, like for example, A, C, G, that codes for a particular amino acid that is used to produce a particular protein. And so basically, all the information to synthesize the proteins in your body are contained in the DNA. All right? So the thing is, there's a lot of information in this DNA. All right? In fact, in the human genome, there's somewhere between 2 and 3 billion, a little closer to 2 billion of these base pairs. Now, let me ask you a question. Could molecules randomly bumping into each other, just bouncing around and bouncing one another, could that spontaneously produce a code? Common sense says no. By the way, second law of thermodynamics also says no, just so you know.
Okay.
That does not happen. Nature never spontaneously creates information. Never. It creates order, but not information. We're talking about a lot of information. Let's think about the simplest living thing. Forget a human being. That's way too much today, honestly. How about a very simple bacteria, 100 million pairs instead of 2 billion? All right, let's just cut it in half and in half again. 25 million base pairs. Let's imagine 25 million letters. Imagine them putting them in a bag, throwing it up in the air, and when they land, you could read it like a book. Because 25 million letters, that's like 10 books. And by the way, what language would it be in? Hungarian. Let's just say Hungarian. What are the probability that molecules randomly, and by the way, you got to make the nucleic acids, never mind that. What's the probability that 25 million base pairs could somehow accidentally bump into each other, hook up together, and then be able to produce a living thing, to be readable, if you will? I'm telling you, that probability is calculated as this: zero. literally zero. In mathematics, there's the official zero, which is like 10 to the minus 50 or whatever. It goes beyond that, because here's the thing. The only thing in the universe that creates proteins is DNA. But guess what the only thing that creates DNA is? Proteins. You know about the chicken and egg? You know the whole chicken and egg thing? Which came first? I'm telling you, the chicken and egg thing is nothing compared to this one. Which came first, atheist? DNA or protein? Because here's the thing. This living thing, which would have to spontaneously form, never mind the cell membrane and the lipid layer and all that kind of stuff, this thing would have to have both the proteins and the DNA, because again, the DNA wouldn't be made by the proteins, but the proteins wouldn't have been made by the DNA. So in other words, what we're saying is, the proteins that would make the DNA and the DNA that would make the same proteins would have to come together in the same place, sort of self-assemble into a living thing. See, some people like that. You think that's God stepping in. What did God say? There you go. Now, like I said, nature does spontaneously create order, such as a massive crystal like that. But nature does not create information. There's a lot of atheists who are convinced that life just came about by, you saw that, a singular series of beneficial accidents. The problem is there's no model that works, there's no theory. And attempts to sort of create a model always involve putting in a certain amount of information. All their attempts have that. He's like, duh, don't you understand? All right. So again, a good illustration would be a house of cards. Let's just say by some zero probability event, you would create these molecules and they come together. It'd be like you take a pile of cards and you take a lawn blower, and throw it at the cards. You know what I'm saying? The instant the house of cards was built, it would immediately disappear. Because they talk about chemical evolution and molecules getting more complex over time. I'm telling you folks, this is nonsense. All right, even Charles Darwin said, it is mere rubbish at this point to think of the origin of life. Because remember, the theory of evolution is not a theory of the origin of life. It's the theory of origin of species. So even Darwin said, you guys are crazy if you think that could happen. Because Darwin was a deist. If you read his Origin of Species, he talks about the deity creating life and that sort of stuff. All right, so that's a little bit of biochemistry, a little biochemistry. Some friends from San Francisco I haven't seen for a really long time. Hello. Anyway, physics. Let's talk about physics. Now, before the 1940s or 50s, scientists were unanimous in this one thing, which is that the universe is eternal. They believed the universe existed forever. Okay, that was the standard accepted, acknowledged by virtually all physicists. All right, it's called the steady state theory, if you will. The question is, why did they believe that? Was it because of evidence? No. Now, scientists are supposed to believe things because of experimental evidence, but there was none. Why did they believe that? For philosophical reasons. Because what is the alternative? Either the universe is eternal or it was created. Can you think of another option? I don't know of any other options. Those are the only two. So why did they believe the universe was eternal? I believe because the alternative had theological implications which made atheists feel very, very uncomfortable. The problem is, the Bible has said all along, Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand the universe was created so that what is seen has been made from things that are not visible. And the entire universe was made from an invisible creator, if you will. Then you might be aware that in the late 1920s, Hubble discovered the redshift. It's kind of like this. So when something's going away from you, you hear a lower frequency. Same with light. If things are moving away from us, the light is shifted toward the red. Blue is higher frequency. Red is lower frequency. So this red shift means everything in the universe that's not close to us is going away from us at a very fast pace. So Hubble and others decided that that was evidence that the universe had at one time been smaller. In fact, they proposed this crazy idea of what we call the Big Bang model. And by the way, it's not that something was there and it exploded. The Big Bang model essentially proposes this. There was nothing. No energy, no matter, even no time. If you ask what happened before the Big Bang, that's a nonsense question. That's a meaningless question. And then at one instant in time, the entire universe, all its energy and matter and everything, was created but in a brilliant flash of light. Oh, that sounds familiar also, doesn't it? Now, obviously, as soon as physicists realized, cosmologists realized, the universe was expanding at a very fast rate, they all conceded and said, yeah, right, the universe was created. No, that's not what it was, folks. There was a lot of fighting over this. And they created this idea of a steady state and all this other theories I won't go into. But then in the 1960s, accidentally, they discovered the background radiation and some other stuff. The bottom line, by the 60s, finally, praise God, physicists caught up with what the Bible had been saying all along, which is there is a creator. The universe was created something from nothing. Now, a good question, if you have an atheist friend or a agnostic friend, ask them very politely, why does anything exist? It's a simple question. Why does anything exist? Never mind why all the elements and all that. Just why does anything exist at all? And the only logical answer is that it's always existed. Except the problem is science doesn't allow for that. By the way, Hindu cosmology and Buddhist cosmology requires an eternal universe because that's, pantheism. And pantheism requires an eternal universe. That's another subject. All right, great. So physicists now agree the universe was created. Thank you very much. Then they got the multiverse theory. You can ask a question about that. All right, now next, let's talk about the fine-tuned universe. Now, all right, and so physicists and cosmologists, as they're beginning to unfold this Big Bang model to kind of explain sort of the evolution of the universe, they notice a few interesting facts, which is the fancy way of saying it is the universe is finely tuned. In other words, there's so many parameters that define the universe that are so precisely tuned that if you change them the slightest amount, everything falls apart, we wouldn't be here. All right? So, for example, would you agree that that's a small number? It's a pretty small number. Okay, 59 zeros and a 1. Turns out there's this thing called the universal gravitational force, which is a very small force. Otherwise, I'd be, whoop, and I'm like, it'd be too strong a force. All right, it's very weak, but it acts over vast distances. And it turns out, as they were beginning to analyze this event, they discovered that if the force of gravity had been bigger than it is by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created.
Wow.
If it was smaller than it is by that fraction, then stars and galaxies never would have been formed. So a good question for your materialist friend is, why does gravity exist? I mean, why? Well, we know, because it's all about us. It is, in this sense. Right? You say it's not all about you, it's all about Christ. But creation actually is actually all about us. It really is. All right. So to illustrate how unlikely this could happen by accident, let's say I had a friend who won the Super Lotto. What would you say? Yeah, great. Hey, disciple, why are you gambling? But never mind that. You can buy, I've never bought one. To me, it's just like voluntary taxes. If people want to pay voluntary taxes, that's okay with me. I don't pay voluntary taxes. I only pay the ones I have to pay, but never mind. Let's imagine that your friend then won the Super Lotto the next week. What if they won it the third week? They would be in jail. The probability, let's just accept that gravity exists at all. Let's just accept that as a given thing, which cannot be explained other than from God, I believe. What are the probability that it would have the right value so that stars could exist? It'd be like winning the Super Lotto 6 times in a row. Okay. I've got my finger right here. Okay. All right. But here's the thing. The next slide, don't even worry about it. Don't worry about it. I should just stop using that slide. It turns out there are more than 30 parameters that sort of define how the universe works at all. There's four forces and many other things. And every single one of them, if you change them just the slightest amount, the whole thing doesn't work. So if you wanted to get the right gravity force, if you're sort of playing with it, well, you'd have to get the other ones right first. Otherwise, nothing would work. Too many parameters. That's the whole idea of the fine-tuning. It's like a bunch of instruments sort of all randomly changing their frequency, and they all happen to hit the right frequency. It never happened. That's why you have the master violin person. Everybody goes to that one. It's kind of an analogy here for us. So, for example, I'll just choose the strong nuclear force. That's the one that holds protons and neutrons together. If that was a few percent larger, we wouldn't have any hydrogen. If we didn't have any hydrogen, then we wouldn't have stars, and that'd be a problem. If it was only a few percent weaker, then we'd have only hydrogen, nothing else. Also a problem. And the question is this: why? How could it be? How could we live in a universe that's finely tuned to levels of precision that are mind-boggling in how precise they are? And is it reasonable, even rational, to imagine this is just an accident? I say, no. How could you think that? How could you believe that? Finely tuned instrument built by humans, good to one part in a billion. Okay, that doesn't happen, by the way, just so you know. Fred Hoyle, famous physicist, said a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. Anthony Flew, the most famous atheist in the last half of the 20th century, finally, 2004, he gave up. He said, all right, it's true. All right. Obviously, there's a creator. Became a deist. So, Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what is made, so that people are without excuse. And here's the thing. Who has the least excuse possible for not believing in God? It's a scientist. So I say, do not be intimidated by bald white men with glasses, I guess. I don't know. Really. Actually, praise the Lord. We got a lot more women and color and all inside. I praise the Lord for that. Praise God. And again, atheists and agnostics, they come across, they get kind of aggressive sometimes. And we get intimidated. Don't do that. I was in a van a few years ago at a conference, science professor conference. We were going between venues, I don't know, 8 or 10 of us. And this woman said, Christianity, what a stupid religion. She said, did you know that it says in the Bible that if you wear clothing with more than one material, that you have capital punishment for that? What a stupid religion. And I said, excuse me, the Bible doesn't say that. By the way, it doesn't say that. She said, oh, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. So I said to her, you know, I've read the Bible through a few times. You know, people say the Bible has all these errors and stuff. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. And then, all right, I pulled my Bible out right there with 8 or 10 professors. And the thing is, I had to find that passage in Leviticus. Right. Could you find that passage in Leviticus? Now, I knew it was on the right-hand side of the page, about halfway down. I knew that. Quick prayer, and I read the passage. Illustrates the point. People in the van were laughing with her. She was totally wrong. You know, I'm a scientist, physics and chemistry professor, PhD in both. And, you know, I'm trained to be skeptical. It's kind of my job to be skeptical. And I'm telling you, I have not found a single science error in the Bible yet. So now we're going to go to part two of our little talk here, and then we'll take an extended question and answer, which is part A was why science says it borders on irrational for anyone to believe there's not a creator. Question part two. Well, okay, then which creator, which God, which? What we know now is we have very, very smart and very, very powerful. That we got going for us. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the Bible. Now, here's a quote from Dallas McCown, an evolutionist, famous atheist evolutionist. Christianity is scientifically unsupported, probably insupportable. Thank you for saying probably, at least. Philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. There you go. Throw it out there. And all his atheist friends, yeah, everybody knows that. All right, I've got a question. Which historical event in the Bible that's recorded, is there an archaeological discovery that proves that not to be true?
Right.
Do you have a single example? Please just give me one. They said there's no such thing as Nineveh, then they discovered Nineveh. They said there's no such thing as the Hittites, and then they discovered the Hittite Empire. And it goes on and on and on. So, okay, thank you for saying that, but what's that mean? Philosophically suspect at best. I would put Christian philosophy, Christian theology, up against, postmodernism, all those philosophies. Totally. In fact, I'm going to do a talk on that in Haiti in a few days. All right. So anyway, but scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. I'm going to say that that is not true. Now, I'm just going to use a couple of examples. There could be many, many more. So this is the thing. It's called the Papyrus Ebers. It is sort of like a PDR, physician's desk reference of Egypt, ancient Egypt, from roughly 1500 B.C. The oldest manuscript we have is around 1200 B.C., but it's been estimated from 1500 B.C. And it's a compendium of the medical knowledge of the ancient Egyptians. Now, I think it would generally be accepted that probably of all the ancient cultures, the ones that had the most collected knowledge about medicine would probably be the Chinese culture and perhaps the Egyptian culture. All right, now the timing of this is pretty significant because 1500 BC, roughly same time as Moses, roughly. Now let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. Prevent hair from turning gray, anointed with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, and the fat of a rattlesnake. All right. A mixture of six fats, namely those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex, prevent hair loss. Clearly, I've not been using that. Now, I think the reason they used this was to be more attractive to the women. Women, would you be hanging out with somebody who's got those six fats on their head? That's kind of gross. Now, we're laughing about this, but actually, this is really actually not funny. Because the average lifespan at that time was around 20 years or so. Not because people couldn't live to be 80, but because almost everyone died of some sort of infectious disease.
Oh, wow.
That's why.
Okay.
All right. It's not that human lifespan wasn't that long. It's just almost everybody died. Let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat, moisture from pig's ears, excrement. Yes. Excrement, including even human excrement, was used as medicine. So I got a little infection, smear some of that on there and see how it works. Okay. Now, again, we're laughing at it, but there's a dark side to this. And then there's the statement in Exodus 15:26 where God says, if you will obey the commandments I'm giving today, I will not bring on you any of the diseases of your neighbors. Okay? Now, I have a good friend of mine. It's John Clayton. Who here knows of John Clayton? Probably a few of you do. Yeah, okay. He's the most well-known, I guess, Christian evidence guy in the Churches of Christ. And he tells the story. He's told it many times. He was an atheist. His parents were both philosophers at Columbia. He was an atheist working for Madeline O'Hare. He was writing a book. The title was The Bible, a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. And in doing his research, guess what happened? Became a Christian. Now, here's the point, and I want you to pay attention to this point. If the Bible was what my friends in that band said it is, then it would have lots of things like this and like this. And simple question, does it have things like that? The answer is, no, it does not. Not at all. All right, so let's look at a few examples. For example, Leviticus 11. You're aware that certain meats are not allowed to be eaten. According, you know, I'll talk about the fact that that's not our case and why. But nevertheless, for the Jews, they were not able to eat pig. They were able to eat beef. They weren't able to eat pork. All right, they weren't able to eat crustaceans, only fish with scales. Now, call it an accident, call it luck, whatever you want. But it just so happens, every single meat that he said you couldn't eat is relatively far more dangerous in terms of the diseases it carries. And every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe. Now, if this was the only example from the Old Testament, you could probably defend the idea that it was lucky, I guess. I was in Venezuela a few years ago, and I speak Spanish, but I didn't know what was on the menu. So I said, just bring me that one. And they brought out a plate of raw beef. All right? I'm thinking, all right, amen. Because even raw, I'm not saying just go out and make a habit of eating raw beef, but the fact is beef, even raw, is relatively safe. All right? And pork, on the other hand, carries at least 22 known diseases, including trichinosis, a deadly disease. All right. And by the way, pork, if handled correctly by modern techniques and all this sort of stuff and hygiene and all that, is relatively safe. But please cook your pork pretty much all the way through. Okay? Again, fish with scales, sushi, raw oysters, raw clams. Man, I'm telling you, you might as well go to Las Vegas and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay? Again, if this was the only example in the Old Testament, that itself, I'm a skeptic. I'm like, all right, fine. So I got to accept everything and give my life to Christ because of that. I know, it's a bit of a stretch, maybe, but it's sort of cool. And remember, those other things, like, you know, the lizard's blood and swine's teeth that's not there. Here's another one. Oh, yeah, here you go. This is a quote from a Hebrew source, not in the Bible, of course. Look at this one. The gnat, feeble creature. Oops. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Stop there. Basically, this Jewish person who wrote this, didn't write the Bible writing this, said flies don't have poop. Is that true? No. That's not true. All right, that's a science error. None of those in the Bible. None. Not one. All right, is it specific against the poison of the viper? So you get, bitten by a snake, and you take your flies, you crush them up, put them on there, and it'll help you out. Okay. All right, here's another one. This is actually not in Leviticus. This is Numbers. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the third and seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent and furnishings and the people who were there. So if you touch a dead body, you are unclean. And why would God say that? It seems kind of harsh because generally it was almost always the family members who prepared the body for the funeral. And therefore they were unclean and not even able to take part in the funeral. Why would God do that? Well, God doesn't always tell us why. One of the things to learn from this lesson is if God tells you to do something and you don't know why, do it anyway. It's not his job to tell you why. Often he does, but sometimes he doesn't. In this case, he didn't. Ignaz Semmelweis. Why would anybody name their son Ignaz? I don't know. He is Hungarian. I was speaking in Budapest on this topic. I said he was Serbian. They said, no, he's not. I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure he's... No, he's not. And they took me that afternoon to his house. And he's... He did live in Serbia. Never mind. Okay. Anyway, he was working in a woman's hospital, and in this woman's hospital, 1 out of 6 women died in the hospital. Now, you know, back then, generally people didn't have babies in the hospital. It's not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because the hospital was the worst place to ever go, especially to give birth. And what he noticed is in his hospital, the doctors, the physicians would come in the morning, go to the basement to the coroner's place and examine the bodies of those who died and proceed immediately to the ward and treat the female patients. So, Ignaz Semmelweis, from now on, when you touch a dead body, wash your hands. And by the way, the hyssop, and oil of hyssop, and water and ash, that is a recipe for soap. I don't know if you knew that. That's what it is. All right? Now, the scientists were saying the reason the women were dying is because of constipation and poisonous air, and also because the women were hysterical. Typical man. Typical. All right? And then what some of I said is, not only that, but even between living patients. Because germ theory had not been discovered yet. It was in the process of coming out at this time. Pasteur had already proposed it. But anyway. And so the death rate went from 18% down to 0.5%. They should have had a marching band parade and celebrated him. Actually, a few months later, they fired him because they were tired of all these restrictions. You can imagine what happened to the death rate. And Semmelweis died of an infection not that much longer. Kind of a sad story. Now let's go back to the prescription. Oil of hyssop, ashes, and water, which is, you know, basically ashes, and that's how grandma made soap. Basically lye and lard, essentially. Okay, but it turns out oil of hyssop is a very oily herb. It's related to thyme. And one of the compounds in the oil of thyme and hyssop is thymol. There it is. There's the structure. Now, I teach organic chemistry. And when I teach organic chemistry, I tell them when we get to phenols. Anybody hear phenols? All right. Good. I tell them one of the properties of phenols is they're all antibacterial. They're antiseptic. In other words, this compound is not poisonous to humans, but it kills bacteria. So here's what's interesting. You know that smell in the hospital, that medicine smell? It's thymol or related compounds. So here's the thing. God said, if you touch a dead body, wash your hands, your whole body, and even everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. And then on the seventh day, do it again, and then you'll be clean. Interesting. All right, let's go on to another example. Here we go. Leviticus 13:46 about certain skin diseases, obviously most famously leprosy. And the Bible prescribed what seems like a very, very harsh thing to do when somebody has leprosy, which is complete 100% quarantine. Leprosy was the most feared ancient disease. It didn't kill the most. Cholera killed many more. Malaria killed many more. Yellow fever killed many more. But leprosy was just a horrible, horrifying way to die. I'm going to leave that slide very quickly. Okay? Here's what's interesting. In the 16th century, some monks living in Scandinavia were reading the Old Testament. By the way, back then, leprosy was rampant in Europe. There's a reason it left Europe before other parts of the world. So what they did is they said, let's try it. And within two or three generations, leprosy was virtually non-existent. Simply by following the simple biblical admonition. Again, we do not need to follow these admonitions, all right, because we're not under the Old Testament law. All right, here's one. I got two more examples. Okay, Leviticus 7:14, the life of every creature is in its blood. That's why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Now, again, in each one of these commandments, he doesn't say why specifically, at least from a health perspective. All right, but we know with science, but also each one of these, even the thing related to being unclean, which is a metaphor for sin. In this case, the life is in the blood. Can you see some theological implications of that? All right, great. Now, basically, do you know what the most common treatment for infectious diseases was in the Western world in the 18th and 19th century? It's called bloodletting. All right, and basically, the theory was when you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. That's how it spreads. You know what? That's actually perfectly logical. It's also wrong, but it's perfectly logical. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Science said the disease is in the blood. Who was right? I don't know about you, but if I've been, if these are instruments used for bloodletting. It's believed that George Washington actually died of multiple bloodlettings. All right. The life is in the blood. And obviously, if you have an infectious disease, the last thing you want to do is remove some of your blood, which has the white blood cells and the leukocytes and all those T cells and all that stuff. Last example. This one actually does not come from the law of Moses. It comes all the way from Genesis. All the way back to Genesis chapter 17. For generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Okay? Now, two questions. Why circumcision and why on the eighth day? Circumcision, that's slightly dangerous. So why would God have commanded male circumcision? Did God explain to Abraham why he needs to do circumcision? Is there some spiritual, metaphorical, sort of symbolic meaning behind circumcision in the New Testament? Absolutely. Right? That's in Colossians chapter 2. The circumcision done by Christ. So there's that. But why circumcision? Well, think about this. Almost everyone back then died from either a bacterial or a yeast infection, or occasionally also viruses, of course. And let me see. Bacteria and yeast, they want to grow wherever it's dark, warm, and wet. So where is the darkest, warmest, wettest place on a guy? Okay? How many lives saved by male circumcision? Generally, more female lives saved than male lives, actually.
Right.
Generally. Okay? Actually, it's been shown, AIDS, for example, AIDS, the rate of AIDS passing from male to female drops more than 60% if the male has been circumcised. By the way, the Bible has a better way to prevent the spread of AIDS, which is one person, one male, one female for life. That would end the AIDS epidemic. Not that we should, you know, I'm not putting that out there as a joke, because this is real and serious, and we need to have compassion, not judgment. That's not the right attitude. Nevertheless, all right, but why on the eighth day? All right, it turns out that when a human child is born, they have no vitamin K. Vitamin K is a fairly large nonpolar molecule which does not pass through the placenta. So if you were to circumcise an infant when it's born, that would be a problem. They tend to bleed out. Now, by the way, the vitamin K is not what forms the clot. It's actually this protein called prothrombin. Prothrombin. That's the protein actually responsible for the blood clotting. And when a baby's born, there's a little bit of prothrombin, but not very much. Then what happens? The baby's born, and the vitamin K comes from bacteria in your gut. That's why, you know, a lot of taking too many antibiotics is actually not very good for you. It kills those good bacteria. Anyway, so what happens is the baby, you know, eats from mom, gets vitamin K, starts producing prothrombin. I'm going to show you a graph. The graph will be amount of prothrombin in the blood system versus time after birth. Here's the graph. Okay. Like I said, there's some prothrombin even at birth, but not much. It drops because there's no vitamin K. And then it goes up to an unusually high level, and then it drops to an equilibrium level. So guess what the safest day to circumcise a male child is? The ninth is, in terms of statistics and all that sort of stuff, the ninth day and the seventh day are just as good. You know, why did God say the eighth day? Because, you know, to the Jews, the number 12, that was a cool number. The number 3, why 8? I don't have any spiritual significance to number 8. But I think I know why God said to circumcise on the eighth day. So to the atheist, I would say, You know, we got some pretty good evidence here for the inspiration of the Bible. By the way, I'm fully convinced beyond, like, there is just no doubt from the evidence the Bible is inspired by God. So let's say this is all the evidence that the Bible is inspired by God. The science portion of the evidence is like this much, but it's worth noting. All right. So I would say, first of all, from the perspective of a scientist who knows the nature of the universe itself to the extent they know it, how could you not believe in God? And then as I look at the Bible and I compare it to the other scriptures of human beings, I say, how could you not believe specifically in the Bible? All right. By the way, this is my proposal for how Abraham figured out it was on the eighth day. He did a double-blind experiment. So, you can laugh at that one. That's actually funny. Okay, I don't think so. Now, these are some other reasons I believe the Bible's inspired. Right? The title was Faith and Science and all that kind of stuff. I'm telling you, the Messianic prophecies, that's crazy stuff. And, you know, fulfilled types of prefigures, historical, actually, all this other stuff. All right, by the way, this is roughly 1/4 of the way through my slideshow. I got stuff about evolution and stuff about the relationship between science and Christianity, and all that other stuff, but I'm going to stop. Yes, time to stop, because I think we have only 50 minutes to go. Question and answer. Sorry, I should have stopped at least 5 minutes ago. I apologize. Any questions? Okay, right here.
Do you have a book?
Do I have a book? Yes, it's my 15 books, actually. But one of them is titled, Is There a God? And there are copies downstairs with all this material. Thank you for that softball question. That's a great one. So she's referencing the Urey Miller experiment in the 1950s. In the 1950s, what Urey Miller did was they took a mixture of nitrogen, hydrogen, ammonia, methane, hydrogen, and water, and they mixed them up together, and they collected, by distillation, the stuff that was produced, and it produced several amino acids. Now, first of all, as an organic chemist, I say, of course it did. I mean, of course. I mean, you didn't even have to do that experiment, as if that experiment proved anything, because we already knew that. And they were only doing that experiment in order to try to prove something which it didn't prove. All right? But here's the thing is, having amino acids, oh, thank you very much. I do a lecture when I teach on the philosophy of science, and we talk about you need monomers, that's the amino acids, the nucleotides, the saccharides, and the lipids. Then you need the polymers, all right, which is these molecules formed of hundreds of those things all connected. And then you need, the next step is information. All right, and the fact that you can make a few amino acids, thank you very much, as if any organic chemist didn't already know that. What's that have to do with creating a living thing? Besides, not only do you have to create amino acids, you also have to create nucleotides. And by the way, nucleotides have been shown to self-assemble, as do amino acids. But the thing is, the chemical environment in which you assemble amino acids doesn't make nucleotides. And the chemical environment which makes nucleotides doesn't make amino acids. And by the way, you also have to have lipids, those whatever those are. And you have to have carbohydrates, sugars. So you have to have all four of those to come in a single place. And are carbohydrates ever made spontaneously? Yes, but not in the same place you make amino acids or lipids, for that matter. And again, all chemists know that these, because of the second law of thermodynamics, large molecules always fall apart. So if you were ever to somehow, remember that house of cards thing, if you were to somehow create a polypeptide of, say, 50 amino acids, then over time it would simply degrade. These things are not stable. So these large molecules outside of a membrane, a bilipid membrane, are not even stable. So the Uri Miller experiment is not interesting, in my opinion, as an organic chemist, and it does literally nothing. Nothing, literally nothing, to establish a model by which life can come about spontaneously. Okay? Yes. Another question. He said, didn't they show that because hydrogen's too light, therefore that was not a valid experiment? True, but in my opinion, it doesn't matter, because the bottom line is, if you had methane and ammonia and water and a spark, you'd get amino acids. So all they need to do, that was probably a Christian trying to find an excuse to ignore that, I think anyway. I hope not, but it might have been. The fact is that the molecules that were almost certainly existing in the early Earth, with lightning or the energy from volcanoes, almost certainly amino acids were created spontaneously. But to say that that means we now know how life was created is to speak crazily, in my opinion. Another question. Yes?
So, John, very, very quickly. So next time I go to a restaurant and I order steak, should I have it well done or medium rare?
No. I eat my steak rare. I like steak rare. Okay? It's too dry. How do people eat well-done steak? I don't know about that.
This is a question for you personally in practice on how you approach people with different prowess of knowledge and coming from an atheist background or spiritual background. How are you exercising compassion when conveying this information, yeah, not from an empirical standpoint?
Right. So you're saying, basically what I've said here, kind of, I've implied, it sounds kind of mean almost, that these people are irrational. I've kind of said that. And I would say that, and so, therefore, how do you treat people that you believe are behaving irrationally? That's called human beings. They're like that all the time. We've certainly been experiencing that lately. All right. But that's a good question. I'd say we need to show compassion always. God says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Not that he doesn't desire sacrifice, but he desires mercy. Mercy always first. So I say we need to find common ground with anybody. Common ground. All right, and so, in fact, to some extent, some of our common ground is against some of the sort of wacky Christians sometimes, honestly, that I shouldn't go into that. But I would just say, find common ground. Don't just sit down and say, you are an irrational, crazy person. You're stupid. How could you possibly believe that? Don't act the way that person did in that van. Don't ever do that. Our weapons are not the weapons of the world. Our weapons are truth and love. Isn't that what Jesus came to bring? Grace and truth. So I would say just always grace and truth. Correct, proper mixture. You should be good to go. All right. I've got time for one more question. Nobody's asking me about the age of the earth or evolution. I thought somebody would have done that by now. And we got to end. We got to end at 12 o'clock.
This may be relatively quick.
All right.
Okay. So the Bible supports astrophysics, and what would your commentary be on life outside of planet Earth?
Yeah. So what about life outside of the Earth? I'll put it this way. Life would not be created spontaneously. That just will not happen. However, it is entirely possible that life could literally travel from one planet that could support life to another planet that can support life. In fact, scientists have found a number of actual meteorites from the planet Mars. So if life had existed on Mars, there's a very good chance, because bacteria can exist at zero. Remember I mentioned life between minus 20 and 80. Bacteria can live outside that range easily. All right, and so spores can last for thousands, even millions of years, believe it or not. So I believe that within a solar system, with one life-carrying planet, probably another one would also have life eventually. So I would be slightly surprised if there was never life, a very, 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 very simple life on Mars, for what it's worth. But as far as life somewhere else, I have no way to comment on that. I have no idea. It is possible in the next 20 to 30 years with that new telescope that they'll be able to detect actual molecules in atmospheres. So it's possible that that question would be answered. But there's one book that does not answer that question. It's called the Bible. And then there's the classic one. What if there was, you know, advanced, you know, God's image, God, and, you know, the image of God, people, another planet. Would Jesus have to go there and die there too? You know, or would they somehow just subliminally know that he did it over here? Those are some of those fun questions. There is no evidence of extraterrestrial life at this point. None. No matter what books you read and whatever conspiracy theories you're into, there is no evidence at this point. But I am an agnostic on that. I'm a full agnostic on that. I don't know, and the Bible doesn't help. All right, great.
Dive into the probability of the Old Testament, how God gave the people what they needed to survive and live and be healthy and live for hundreds of years, and then compared to what we're doing to ourselves nowadays and the chemicals and the many different things that we...
I talk a little bit about that in my book, Is Through God.
Yeah, we're very healthy people. We're well into our 70s and we're in our 40s.
Yeah, the reason we live on average longer is because of the medical revolution.
Yes, I understand.
Pasture.
But it's chemically driven. I'm talking about the natural type things that God provided for the Old Testament.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, okay. I wondered if you got into it. Because we have a doctor that really does. He uses the Bible to teach us some of the Old Testament and the original teachings of the Bible taught.
Okay. Well, again, like I said, if they were to obey the commandments that God gave them, on average, they would have a longer lifespan.
Right.
I believe they did. That partially explains why the Jews were able to reproduce relative to other people.
Yeah, no,
good.
Yeah.
Hello.
Would I be able to get your PowerPoint so I can just like...
Sure, just go to my website, evidencefortchristianity.org.
Nice.
If you can't find my website, just Google my name.
Okay.
I answer over 3,000 questions at that website, and I have hundreds of PowerPoints. This one's already there. Just go there. It'll be right at the front page.
Thank you so much.
Sure. All right, yeah.
Really appreciate this whole thing.
Sure.
I kind of did have a two-parter. One was about the age of the Earth.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Outside of that. Go ahead.
So the evidence says the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old. It's on there. From Uranium. There's three or four ways to calculate what the age of the Earth probably is. And some are, like, Uranium narrows it down. Others, like distance of the moon from the Earth, broader, but somewhere in that range. So the question is, what about Genesis 1? And I would argue that the kind of literature that Genesis even is, and the Near Eastern way of thinking, I believe these days are metaphorical.
Sure. I think we're expected to, as Christians, interpret it as a metaphor.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of an atheist.
There were a number of even early Christian commentators like Origen and my brain's probably ran out, who basically said these days are metaphorical, even before there was science.
And then my next one, I created in a specific way, but it's assuming that the instructions that the Bible lays out could come from intuition.
From intuition?
Assuming that that's possible. Instead of divine intervention, as a skeptic, how do we assign belief to there being a creator?
First of all, the skeptic doesn't believe in intuition. That intuition is a meaningless idea. What would he, to an atheist, what would intuition even be?
Well, I'm just saying as an example, that whole idea of like waiting 8 days before you're actually clean.
Yeah.
Assuming that that instruction could come from intuition.
How could it?
I'm just saying assuming.
Right? Well, that assumption is wrong.
Or an atheist.
Right, but the atheist...
If they're not going to draw...
Okay, first of all, atheists do not believe in anything supernatural, by definition. They don't believe in justice is a meaningless word. And intuition, intuition is an undefined thing. It's literally undefined.
Sure.
So you're proposing that they assume something exists, which they assume doesn't exist. So I don't think you have to worry about that conversation.
I guess my question is, how do you assign belief to something without direct evidence?
Well, we have direct evidence that the Bible is inspired by God. Put it this way. There are many things in the Bible I know because of evidence, and there's many things in the Bible I know because it's in the Bible. For example, I know the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence. I know that Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. I know that life was created and that God is real because of the evidence. I believe in Adam and Eve because the Bible says Adam and Eve. I believe in heaven because the Bible says heaven. There are many things in the Bible that I believe because I believe the Bible is inspired by God. That is not circular reasoning. It's not. So basically, if the evidence makes it clear, for example, that Daniel is an inspired book, then it's a reasonable inference that the entire Bible is inspired. It's only a reasonable inference. I cannot prove to you that Esther 12, verse 2 is inspired. I have no evidence of that. I have no evidence that Titus 1, verse 7 is inspired. What I have evidence is the Bible is inspired. And so therefore, there are things that I believe by faith. And I would say that immediately to an atheist. I have no evidence of heaven. None. Absolutely none. None. There's tons of things in the Bible that I believe by faith. But it's not blind faith. It's far from blind faith. See what I'm saying? It's a great question. That's my answer. So, yeah, the atheist says, yeah, I believe you believe everything by faith. That is not true. Can we sit down and talk about it? And pull out just messianic prophecies. I would use that. Rather than this, I would use that, actually, even with my atheist friend, honestly.
Yeah,
I'm
really curious on how to approach that from an atheistic standpoint. Like, how are you supposed to communicate faith to someone who's only going to assign belief?
From the evidence. From the evidence.
Well, like heaven and even the story of Adam and Eve.
Again, evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. Got it?
Yeah.
Now, if the Bible is inspired by God, that implies some things that I can't prove. I cannot prove that David killed Goliath. There's absolutely no evidence. None. Why do I believe it? Because of all the other evidence. See that? So there are things that we believe because of other things that we believe. And if this is true, then that has to be true whether I have evidence of it or not. Okay? Next. Yes.
Good question. So not to oversimplify things, but if all knowledge comes from God, we know that.
All right. Okay.
That God, in essence, is consistent. He doesn't contradict himself. Then would it be safe to say that both science and the Bible should paint the same picture?
They should paint a picture with a fair amount of overlap, because the Bible doesn't principally deal with science. The Bible, like Galileo said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So the Bible talks about purpose, meaning, right, wrong. Science is useless in that area. Science deals with how long, when, where, how many, that kind of stuff. And the amount of overlap between the two is fairly small. Certain questions do overlap, like, for example, origin of life.
Right.
They kind of both want to, what is a human being? They both want to have those. So in those areas, you have to kind of work some stuff out.
Okay. But there shouldn't be anything that contradicts.
Right. So, for example, what science says a human being is.
Right.
And what the Bible says a human being is should not be in conflict.
Right, right.
What the Bible says the purpose of life is, and science says the purpose of life is, those will not agree at all, because science doesn't discuss that.
Right.
If there's purpose in life according to science, it's to make as many copies of your DNA as possible, which is purpose in quotes, is not even purpose, which would justify a lot of really bad stuff.
Right.
So again, only in the areas where they would have common ground to discuss does the Bible need to be consistent with what science shows us.
Right, right, okay.
All right, so there most questions that science answers, the Bible really has just, what about galaxies and what about viruses? The Bible is useless. It's completely useless on those. So there is no room for conflict. So there's a, but there's an overlap area there. If they don't agree, then that's a problem.
Right.
And in that case, probably science actually wins, probably, because that involves empirical knowledge. All right, but they don't. That's the thing. They don't.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thank you so much.
Hello.
Yeah, just a quick question.
Yeah.
Do you know or you think that it's a cure for cancer?
A cure for cancer? First of all, cancer is plural.
Yeah.
Cancer is not a single disease. There are hundreds of diseases. And put it this way, if you'd asked that question 50 years ago, some medical scientists would have proposed, yes, possibly. But now, none of them would even think of saying that. Because many cancers are primarily genetic. Others are primarily environmental. Some are both. No, the answer is no.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Just want to say hello.
Hi.
Hi. Good to see you.
There's your husband. He wasn't sitting next to you.
No.
All right, that would confuse me. Oh, look at the guy. No, that's not Randy. He's got too much gray hair. Randy wouldn't have that much gray hair. Hello.
Good to see you.
Come down to the book table. I'll be there. We can, just chat.
I'll
be leaving in about 10 minutes or so.
I just want to ask a question about elements.
I'm going to take a woman next, okay? Go ahead.
So helium, there's a finite amount of it.
Yeah.
So what happens when it runs out?
What do you mean it runs out?
Well, we're not going to have helium.
It'll exist. The problem is it'll just be so dispersed we can't use it. Any element that's too widely dispersed you can't use.
Okay, so
right.
What was the use of helium in the first place then?
The primary use of helium is for cooling things, not lifting balloons, not even lifting man-carrying devices. The primary human use of helium is for cooling.
So what happens when we run out of helium?
Then
are
we have a big problem. We'll have to figure out.
Industrially.
In theory, you could use hydrogen to cool things. Hydrogen explodes. It's like they replace CFCs, right? Chlorofluorocarbons. Mm-hmm. And the replacements are not quite as effective, actually.
Yeah.
But the replacement for helium, the only one I know of, is hydrogen. So, yeah, I mean...
We're in trouble, aren't we?
In trouble in what? You couldn't run it. You couldn't have an MRI.
Right, yep.
Anyway, by the way, that's not yours or my problem. That's her problem, not our problem. Seriously.
Okay, good. All right. Good to know.
Nitrogen... thing is, what you're involved, what you do is in liquid nitrogen, it cools down to its vapor, to its evaporation temperature, its boiling temperature, which is 4 Kelvin.
Uh-huh.
Nitrogen has an evaporation temperature of around 80 Kelvin, which is good for lots and lots of things.
Right, but not as good.
Liquid nitrogen you use a lot more than liquid helium.
Yeah.
But for supermagnets, for MRIs and other applications, it's not cold enough. Yeah.
So my actual question was, so Old Testament laws, there's a lot of them that are, as far as we know, focused on like distinction and setting apart. From
exactly. Others. Those were set to teach a spiritual principle.
Yeah, and some that are for like prevention of infectious diseases.
Yeah.
Have we at this point like caught up to those instructions or are there?
I'd say a lot of them. Ask a Jewish person.
Yeah, okay.
Christians too, but Jewish people, Jewish scholars, not just random person. But for example, the thing where you don't cook the calf in its mother's milk, the Jews are all over that one. It's about animal cruelty.
Right.
Okay. The thing with two different crops in the same field or two different materials, that's about purity and not mixing with foreigners. So the Jews have all these things figured out. They had that figured out a long time ago. The medical implications probably are recent. Now, are there going to be further discoveries of things that are in the Bible that are like, oh, sure, of course. Happens all the time.
Yeah. That was my question. Like,
good.
We've gone on from bloodletting and such. But
yes, but we didn't do it because we properly used the Bible. We did do the leprosy thing from proper use of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And
some antibiotics.
The inventors of germ theory, Pasteur was a very devoted believer, by the way, very devoted believer. I don't think he got that from his belief. I don't think he did. All right? I don't think he got it from, Numbers 19.
So we got that several thousands of years later in a very roundabout.
Yeah, Pasteur... Of course, if Pasteur hadn't discovered it, somebody else would.
Yeah.
But if we take the implications of Pasteur's career, hundreds of millions In fact, probably literally billions of lives saved. Billions. Yeah, the greatest advance in science in terms of to improve human life is germ theory. Obviously. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. I'll go to the theme park this weekend, of course. But I had some questions about... Give me your direction and your opinions.
Okay.
On Nephilims.
All right.
And dinos, you know.
Dinosaurs are not mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously not. I mean, dinosaurs sort of disappeared 65 million years before people came around. So what in the world would... Why would... By the way, there's Leviathan. Those are mythical creatures. Are there mythical creatures in the Old Testament? Yes, there are. Because they were used for symbolic, metaphorical reasons. That's Job and others. All right, so anyway, so no dinosaurs in the Bible. And people and dinosaurs definitely did not live at the same time. I know young earth creationists say that. I'm sorry, they're just flat out wrong. All right, but on the other hand, the Nephilim thing, I don't know. So there's two theories. There's two theories on Nephilim. One is that there were actual angels coming down and having, I guess, male angels, I guess, having sex with female humans. And that's the theory in First Enoch, for what it's worth. It's not in the Bible. My personal opinion is, basically, certain guys were having sex with certain women and producing children. And there's the whole children of Seth and all that sort of stuff. And so there were these different lines. And so there was this one branch of humanity, most of whom really just. And this branch from which Noah came, which was, you know, and possibly it was crossbreeding between the, I don't know. Don't even know.
Mystery, huh?
Yep, mystery. Bible doesn't say much about it, and I'm comfortable not knowing.
There you go.
All right?
Thank you.
I'm going to take one or two more, just because I'm running out.
So with the dinosaurs, right? So you have the carbon dating with fossils?
Yeah, carbon dating don't matter with dinosaurs. No, the reason is... Yeah.
What is it?
Too far back. Carbon dating is only good for up to a certain...
The half-life of carbon-14 is around 5,700 years. So... And once something's gone through about six half-lives, it becomes undetectable. So anything more than about 40,000 years old, carbon-14 is completely useless. So age of the Earth, carbon-14, anybody who says, what about carbon-14? You know right away, not that they're dumb or stupid or uneducated, but they don't know what they're talking about in that case. So in order to talk about dinosaurs, we need to use other dating methods. There are a few of them. There's potassium-argon dating, there's thorium-lead dating, there's uranium-lead dating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those dating methods, is it accurate to say that dinosaurs lived that millions of years ago and what the purpose of dinosaurs is?
Purpose? Science doesn't answer purpose questions. It doesn't answer purpose questions. So, yes. Now, are there occasional measurements that don't work with... Because there's the whole fossil index, fossil record, all this sort of stuff. Occasionally, scientists find discordant data. In other words, they'll find a fossil which, according to the thing, should be 140 million years old, but they measure it as 80 million years old, all right? And so there are things that happen, leaching, contamination, things like that. But when scientists take all possible factors into account and they cross-check and all that sort of stuff, uranium dating is pretty good in general. So if they say that this thing was in existence 87 million years ago, all right, 90, 84, but not 2,000 years ago. Even if you have discordant data, it's not like the difference between 4 billion years and 4,000 years. That don't even talk about that. So carbon dating has nothing to do with finding the age of the Earth or the universe anyway, for what it's worth. But we have other dating methods. And here's what I say in my intro to scientific thought class. I say, all right, the evidence says that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Students, does that mean that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old? They say, no, it does not mean that. What does it mean? It means the evidence says that. All right, could there be another explanation for that? Science is all scientific conclusions are tentative. All right?
because in your book you said, in Is There a God? You said something about like the perception of time or something.
I talked about that.
Yeah.
I don't remember the context.
Okay.
I haven't read that book for about 30 years, but no, about 20 years. So what about it? Perception of time.
Something about time is actually compressed, but the way that God created everything is time, the duration of time is actually shorter.
I didn't.
What we believe or what we know.
Now, I definitely did not say that in that book. I can't remember what I was talking about, the thing you're quoting. You'd have to kind of read it to me. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
All right, I'm running out of gas. I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
I did two talks today already.
Hello?
My name
Hello.
Is Jesse. I'm from Boston. I didn't finish up. I owed you a paper.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
COVID hit, and then I got a job promotion, but I am definitely not giving up on
the process. Okay, good.
But I just wanted to meet you.
All right. Anybody with just a burning question? Just a burning question.
Global warming and our effect on
it,
if you believe that.
Climate change? Absolutely.
But like our personal effect on it as humans.
Yeah.
That we're making.
I'll give you an example. I was at a meeting with a bunch of, they're all disciples from our church, sitting down, and we were at a meet, having lunch, and I said, do you believe that global climate change is real? And I said, who do you work for? ExxonMobil. Who do you work for? Shell. You know, it's like, okay. Okay. Absolutely. There is no doubt that human activity is affecting the weather. The only question is, what rate is the change happening? Does natural causes change temperature? There's plenty of evidence for that. But never in history has temperature changed as rapidly as it is right now. Never.
I believe it is also, but I just was curious if there's like any...
No, the Bible doesn't deal with this. People who hold out against that, it's for political reasons.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. I won't say which party they're from, but I know which party they're from. Hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah.
It's political. It's political.
Yeah.
I happen to register in that party, okay?
Yeah. Well.
But there's a lot of nuts in that party. And.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Uh-huh. Yeah. One thing I want to say about the whole Bible, and I do want to, I teach fifth grade kids in Kingdom Kids. I teach fifth grade kids in Kingdom Kids.
Sure.
And one thing I tell them is that the Bible and science never actually conflict.
Right.
But they sometimes talk about the same thing. But when they do talk about the same thing, science is looking at the what and the how, while the Bible is looking at the who and the why.
Exactly.
So you wouldn't find them at ends with each other.
Right.
Even if they seem to be a conflict, it's usually not, because it's almost two different aspects.
It is not. And so what I like is the main thing you said that I really like is the Bible talks about why.
Yeah.
Even a fifth grade can get that.
Yeah.
And the science talks about when and what.
Yes.
And so most things the Bible talks about, there's not much overlap, but you said it wonderfully. I just don't change anything. Keep saying it exactly the way you said it. I wouldn't change it at all. All right, you've been very patient, so.
Well, I don't know if you remember me. I just wanted to
Yes, Samantha, of course. Yes, how's it going?
Yeah.
You were in San Diego before that. You were in like Kansas or Nebraska.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah. Is it Jen? Is
she
Jen here?
Yeah, she left this morning.
Oh, okay.
She's going to. Hi. Wow.
I met you a while back at the School of Missions in Miami.
Oh, good. That's been a while.
Yeah.
All right, folks. I'm shutting it down. The two of us are going to lunch, and I just have to shut it down.
John, you remember being in Mexico 20 years ago?
I've been there many times.
Going to the clinic, and we're playing soccer in the street.
Yeah,
that was
sure.
Me. Remember a big guy called Oscar Hill? And I, we like travel, we were like the place. It was like a Hope Clinic.
Yes, I remember that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was with Oscar.
I definitely remember that, and that was 20. Yeah, 2003, 2002, something like that. Yeah.
I was there in 2002 hanging out.
Yes, I remember that. I very specifically remember that. This is supposed to turn it off, but it's not.
I just want to say hey.
Hi, good seeing you. Thank you for that day. Yeah. Oh, well.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks for the class.
Sure, you're welcome.
Jurassic Park.
Oh, thanks. There's an actual Jurassic Park now?
Yeah, Jurassic Park. It's called Universal Island.
Okay.
And they have Jurassic Park there, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Man, I survived that class, but just barely. So we're going to go to lunch. I'm going to try to do this just for a second. All right, good. Yeah, you missed Jan by just by a few hours. Great, good seeing you. Congratulations. How long have you been married?
Like a year and a couple months.
How wonderful. Treat her right. Better treat her right.
I would tell him about you guys and how good. You took her shape. Well, took me in as like one of your own.
Yes. That's what we do. That's what we do.
So many memories. But how's the mission there?
We're getting going. It's only been 2 months, so it's we don't have a whole lot.
Wow.
I'm going to start walking. Yeah. I can.
This is my wife, Amanda.
Hi. Are we coming to lunch together?
No, I wasn't. I was going to another class.
Aww.
So I'll walk with you to wherever
right.
you're going.
Good.
Can I take a picture?
Sure. Sorry about it. I don't want to be rude.
No. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
Appreciate it.
Hello, everybody. How's it going? Hello. Do you have an opinion?
Well, is it Denny's across the road, or there's some places in the marketplace?
Have you been to the one, the Rosen, for lunch? They've got some really good food over there. It's a little bit expensive.
That's fine.
It's around 20.
That's fine.
All right.
We're going to walk out to the Rosen.
All right, good.
It was delicious.
Oh, good.
It's all I'm going to say. I really enjoyed it.
Well, good.
It was really helpful in terms of, you know, I even get asked by students. I can't obviously overtly share with students, but I teach about Charles Darwin, and I tell them, you know, he believed in God. In Origin of the Species, he mentions about the Creator God. It's not about whether, you know,